Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dave Hemmings, coach at Great Britain's National Centre in Loughborough. I'm going to be talking to Dave about a whole host of things, his career through swimming as a coach, his thoughts on technical development. This really is, for me, one of my favourite episodes so far in terms of how much I learned just from chatting to Dave. Before we get into the interview though, just a quick word from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. So I think it's about time I introduce Dave. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jamie. Nice to be on your podcast.
Why don't we just start with a little bit of background on yourself in the sport and coaching?
Yeah. Well, I started coaching when I was about 18, 19, actually. I finished swimming at a club. I'd always been at Hillingdon Swimming Club in West London. And I was swimming. I was being a swimming teacher at the pool where I trained. My ex coach said, "Oh, do you fancy doing the then C squad, which was like kind of the junior squad within Hillingdon?" I jumped on that, and then really from that point, I've always been just really, really heavily involved in the sport. Learned to love coaching. It's kind of gone in a couple of different directions. I've been a PE teacher. As well, that kind of came off the back of my love for coaching. But really, from being the C squad coach, I moved up to the middle squad, then head coach, and then a few years ago, I decided to take a plunge and be an assistant coach at Loughborough National Centre, which has really led me 5 years on to this point now.
See, in my experience, you know, I've only been around. So I've been kind of coaching for 7 years, but only like around as like a more of a kind of professional coach for the last kind of 3 or 4 years. But in my experience, you seem to be one of the most kind of proactive coaches from the elite level in terms of sharing your ideas and work with other coaches. Is this something that you've always believed in?
Well, first of all, thanks for that. Look, the one thing that I would say is that I'm very, very passionate about the sport, and I'm very conscious, or just very conscious that I want to keep my knowledge as up to date and as good as it can be. So whenever I look into a topic, whether it's technical, physiological, whatever it may be for swimming, I always look at it as CPD for myself. And then it normally turns into a little project that I would do. And then I look at it, and I spent a lot of time on it, and I understand it really well. And I just think to myself, once you're in that position with that information, you've got two options. You either protect it and think that it's something that's so special that's going to make the difference for you, which I don't believe in, and I don't see any logic in, or you share it. And I always go by the way of sharing. I like to think of the bigger picture. I think if, say, somebody like yourself or another coach can, you know, read some stuff that maybe I've spent a little bit of time on, I think that's good for the bigger picture. And certainly when I was a younger coach, one of the things that inspired me the most, that really, really got me highly energized and enthused about the sport, was when I was able to get my hands on articles or listen to coaches that would inspire me. I always just think to myself, like, you know, if I was talking to myself 20 years ago, you know, I would want to meet somebody, okay, that would be willing to share. So that's kind of like my philosophy with it. And, you know, look, one of the things that's quite interesting, I've got some good friends in coaching. Steve Tigg, who's the head coach at University of Stirling, Ian Hume, that's one of the coaches at Loughborough. And both of those coaches have got athletes domestically that are in direct competition with athletes in my group. But we spend a lot of time together and we share, because that's how we get better as coaches. And, you know, and that's just my mindset around that.
I think it's the best way to approach things.
I often get asked, you know, why did I start doing the podcast? Why did I start sharing all these discussions that I have with coaches? And I just think, because I'm in a position, especially at the moment, where I'm only really kind of coaching it as part-time hours, but I'm treating it as like a full-time kind of thing. I'm in a position of luxury where I'm able to take time out and go and visit other coaches, have conversation with other coaches. And there are people that can't do that. So if I can just share the discussions that I'm having, then I benefit from having the discussions, but then everyone else also gets to benefit from that as well. So I think,
I think that what you're doing is excellent. It's not, it's brave as well, because I can remember when I would go to a conference, I'd be quite nervous about going and speaking to a Bob Bowman or a Shannon Rawlinson there. I'd have to pluck up a lot of courage to even go and ask a question, let alone hold a conversation. You know, with coaches, okay, that were in charge of world-class athletes. But the answers that and the information you can collect from starting a conversation is, you know, it's a really great thing. And I think this idea of podcasts and, you know, asking people like Ian Armiger to speak on your podcast is, you know, the value of that's great.
Yeah, I've learned loads, and I've only been doing it less than a year, and I've learned more in this season from doing this than I've probably learned in any other season. So for me, it's been great. You seemed to, from all the information that I've shared with me from you or from other people that's come via you, you seem to have a bit of a really keen interest or almost like an obsession with how you can improve your athletes technically. How important is this, like even at the top level where you're operating?
Well, the first thing I would say is that my obsession probably isn't to make swimmers technically better. My obsession at first was trying to learn what they were doing that was so natural or so good, so I understood it. Because if you can get to that point where you're watching a world-class swimmer and you're understanding what they're doing biomechanically, technically, then that's great knowledge to have. So my main goal is what can I learn from the athletes? Can I absolutely understand what they're doing that makes them go so quick? And if I can do that, and I can understand the intricacies of what they're doing technically, then I think what I'm able to do is suggest tweaks, adjustments, okay, to current swimming styles that I encounter that may be of help. I'll give you like an example. Coach two breaststrokers, Molly Renshaw and James Wilby. And Molly, great 200 breaststroke swimmer, Olympic finalist. But I always struggled to coach speed into her. Her stroke was very long and slightly wide. She had a great draw on the kick. When I started to coach James Wilby, it's the complete opposite. Very, very narrow, very powerful. And when I was thinking to myself, well, you know, how do I encourage Molly to get a bit more speed? I made the comparison to James. I was like, well, really what I've got to try and do maybe is get a little bit stronger. Okay, and I've got to somehow think of to narrow her stroke. And we kind of went on a technical journey, so to speak, in the World Championship year on those two elements. And she ended up with a really big drop at the World Championships into making a 100 final there. So I would say what I've learned from James, I was able to transfer into Molly, or help transfer into Molly. And yeah, she became a lot faster from that. The other thing that I'm quite passionate about is a multidisciplinary approach. So I use the physios and I use the strength and conditioning practitioners to really explore how we can make the athlete more technically proficient. And that might be that they're performing a technique really well, but they need more strength to get more out of that technique. Yeah. Or it might be that I want to make a technical adjustment to the stroke, but they're not able to because they haven't got the flexibility or the range. So a good example of that was we tried to work with Roberto Pavone a few years back to get a higher elbow catch. But actually, his internal rotation on his shoulder wasn't at the level needed to make that position. So on deck, I was saying, hey, just get your elbow higher. How hard can that be? When I spoke to the physio, they were like, well, actually he hasn't got the range in that position, Dave, and we need to do a bit of work on it before he can make that shape. So I think the sports science team certainly now is becoming more important in that process.
Those two examples you just gave there about having to be potentially stronger to enable to make the most of your technique or having a bit more flexibility and range just reminds me so much of conversations I have with parents at an age group level where their child is very good technically. And they keep asking me, look, they do all the technique really well. It looks really nice, but they're just not fast. How can we make them fast? And I have to keep saying it'll happen when they grow into their body, when they become naturally stronger, because the technique's there. They just need to use the technique with a bit more strength. And I think it's a really good example you gave there.
You can jump on the British Swimming website and go to many athletes, the better athletes now, and you can trace their competition best performances over a number of years. And I'll use James for an example, because I did a presentation on him about a month ago, and he, at the age of 15 or 16, had a colossal drop in 1 year. I would probably say that he wouldn't have made nationals or scraped the nationals 12, 13, 14. And then in 1 year, he moved from probably someone that was scraping qualification to winning. And that's not a technical change. It's not something magical that a coach has done something to his stroke there. That's growth and maturation. And that's education. It's always going to be a challenge to explain that to parents and swimmers that are going through a plateau period because they haven't gone through maturation yet. But you know, that's the job of the coach to try their best to educate in that way.
Absolutely. So to talking then about making those technical changes, when you deem them necessary, talk us through the processes that you follow when you look to improve a swimmer technically. Would this differ across different levels of athlete if you're working?
Yeah, I think if I go back to when I was working at the club, one of the things that I was quite keen on was, you know, I love watching the world-class athletes. Yeah. And I would collect videos, okay, from YouTube. And my method of coaching technique there was very exploratory. So what I would do, rather than prescribing, I would prescribe drills, but at the beginning, my brief at the start of the session would be, let's watch this video. And I want you to pick out a couple of points that are really standing out for you on this video. We're going to get in warm up, then we're going to practice those.
Yeah.
And we would practice swimming like different swimmers. We would talk about what the world-class athletes are looking like to make themselves so good. And I think that's a good thing, because what you're doing there is you're educating young athletes, okay, to look at the sport, okay, and draw some comparisons. Because in my opinion, a lot of swimmers develop technique through copying.
Absolutely.
And I always giggle, because when I was coaching brothers and sisters, often they would
the same
swim the pilot. Same. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, why is that? And it's probably just because they copy each other. So I think the exploring technique, you know, for example, freestyle, swimming with high elbows, swimming with straight arms. Okay, learning dives, arms straight forward. Okay, arms come back, then go forward. You know, I think it's really important that the coach has got an understanding of the range of techniques available. And I don't think at an age level it's wrong, okay, to practice different techniques to explore. In terms of as you get older and you move on to the kind of level where I'm lucky to coach now, I think it's really important that I've got a good grasp on style versus technique in the textbook. there are a lot of swimmers, a lot of the best swimmers, that don't swim to the textbook. And it's really important as a coach, you understand what the athlete is doing that's making them fast and effective, and not just try to channel them into swimming one way.
Yeah.
A great example is Siobhan O'Connor. She's got her own unique style. She's very, very fast. My job is to try to understand what's making her so good, but not mess with the style. Okay, because if I could look at, say, her freestyle and say, oh no, you should be absolutely swimming with high elbow technique, but that's not where she sits in her most comfortable place to get the best out of herself.
Yeah.
But there might be small tweaks, okay, that I can help that make her style more effective. And I think sometimes we've just got to be careful that sometimes we can think that technique is just aesthetic, just looking good. Mm-hmm. And there is a bit to that. But I also think it's important that we make sure that we understand what the athlete is doing well and try to develop and encourage that. In terms of how I would go about trying to spot differences, I'm very keen on comparing. So I would regularly get a video. I would put it into a program called Kinovia, which is just you can slow the video down. I would chop pictures out and I would lay them against similar videos of world-class swimmers. And I would be like, right, what is happening here? Frame by frame, where are the differences? And then I would be asking myself, and you know, why is that different? I'd be considering what that means. Yeah. And if I felt that it was appropriate to suggest a tweak or a change, because I feel like it would definitely make the swimmer go faster, then I would look at trying to implement that. I think it's really important that coaches, you know, take videos and analyze and compare. I also think it's important that they use slow motion, because it's very, very difficult in full fast flow to spot anything with the naked eye. Yeah. So for example, if you're analyzing a dive and you're not prepared to watch it in slow motion and cut out 6 to 10 pictures to see what's happening through different phases, you'll probably really struggle to find what you need to work on.
Yeah, I mean, I find that I did before we kind of came to the shutdown. We kind of anticipated there was going to be a break at some point, so we basically just put the camera into every single session and got as much footage as we could to give us something to analyze over the break. And I'll watch a video at full speed and I'll say, oh, there's something there. But it's only when you really slow it right down and watch it slow motion frame by frame that you can actually see, oh, that's what's there and it needs to be there. And you can actually see so much more when it's slowed down. So, yeah.
The drawback of that, and where coaches have to be careful when they're analysing in that way, okay, is they don't lose sight of the fluid motion.
Yeah.
So, for example, you may chop a picture up and think that a certain arm pull or body position needs to be slightly different or worked on, but you also have to consider that in the context of the fluid motion.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really, really important in terms of understanding where the athlete accelerates the water and their own unique style.
Absolutely. So I'd like to find out just a little bit more about your kind of ideas in terms of stroke mechanics. And I think you've already kind of brushed on it with breaststroke, comparing kind of James Wilby and Molly Renshaw. What would you kind of name the most kind of underworked technical component in swimmers for each stroke, and why for you is that crucially important?
Okay. That's a big question.
Yeah.
there's so many areas that you could say are underworked in technique. There's the body position. You could say pulling actions. Is your program working enough on streamline? I think that's different. That's different to all programs and every coach. I probably would say the most underworked area is swimmers' understanding of what they're doing and their reason why. I think you can ask athletes to do certain things, but do they understand why they're doing it? Do they understand why it's going to make them quicker? Because that's a really, really important point. I think the buy-in, okay, for them to really, really focus and work to improve a particular point, you know, they've got to know the reason for that. It might be, this is going to help your fluidity in the stroke. This is a more propulsive position. This reduces drag. One of the things I always try to do with the athletes is if I feel that there's a tweak that needs to be made, I'll explain why. I'll give it a comparison. I'll make sure that we do some work on the video playback so they can see what they're doing and where the tweak needs to be made. And I really want to get them to a point where they can coach themselves.
Yeah.
We're lucky enough to have like some small TVs at Loughborough where we can drop a camera in and we can put it on a 10-second delay.
Yeah.
And what I like to do is to go, right, we're working on this point that we worked on last week that you understand, and I'm going to leave you for 20 minutes now to work on that and make sure that you can spot what we've discussed you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think when we get to that point where the athletes are very, very clear, they can almost self-manage. That's a really, really good thing. I think the other thing that is important to consider as well is breathing. I think that's like, might seem like a simple point.
Yeah.
But actually, when to breathe and how you inhale and how you exhale is really, really important. I think for me, the first time that you really, really see technique start to deteriorate is under fatigue, and often breathing mechanics and breath control is one of the first things to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it was only about a year ago I was doing some work with Abby Wood, an IM swimmer in my group, and we were doing quite a lot of fly long course, and she was really, really struggling. We get to 75 meters and I could see that she began to slip the water, drop her elbows, you know, and she actually looked in quite a lot of distress. And we talked about it, and I said, well, what is happening? And she said, I'm just getting so tired at 60, 70 meters. I'm like, well, what's happening there? I said, to me, it looks like you're slipping so fast that you're not even getting a good breath. She said, I'm not breathing. I'm barely even taking anything in. So we went on, we did a project where she used the power breathe. And we focused on distance per stroke, stroke counting, but we also focused on quality of breath. And at the end of 50 meters or 100 meter efforts, she would have to, you know, tell me, okay, that, you know, we'd have to have a little conversation at the end to check that, you know, she was in control of her breath.
Yeah.
Within a few months, her ability to sustain good technique because her breathing mechanics were better, made a massive difference.
Absolutely.
And I just think that's one that, you know, coaches might want to have a think about.
The body relies on oxygen supply to be able to move effectively. And if you're not getting the breath in, then you're not going to be able to move as efficiently or as effectively. And technique will, as a result, tend to fall away because of that. So I think that's a really, really good point for coaches to think about there.
Certainly on like fly or breaststroke, when the breathing mechanics begin to break down, the urgency to take a breath comes sooner. So for breaststroke, where you're trying to maintain a very, very strong outsweep to set up the collection of the water that then the rest of the stroke cycle follows off, the outsweep just shortens, the head lifts earlier, the hips drop, the legs drop, and the pool's hasn't got as much scope. On butterfly, the same, the head will lift earlier because it's searching for breath. If you lift the head earlier, the elbows will drop, the forearms will slip, the pull will be not as effective, and the motion is more up and down rather than flat and forward. So I think talking about breathing, when and how powerfully you breathe in and out is really, really important for coaches to work with their athletes.
I think it's really important you mentioned breath there for me, because I think I've certainly got a few athletes that tend to lift the head a little bit earlier in the stroke, or tend to be a little bit impatient with getting into the breath, especially when, as they're executing that kick, you want them to be as in line as possible to get the most out of the kick. So I think you're definitely highlighting that not having an urgency to rush the breath, and hence rush the kick or rush anything else within the stroke, is really important there on breaststroke.
Definitely. And there's, you know, great examples of, like, Anton Chupkov, the world record holder on 200 breaststroke. He's the one athlete that, if you can get a video of him underwater, he's got the longest neutral head position in terms of when he outsweeps with his arms. His head is completely neutral when his hands are at the widest point, and his hands are actually higher than his shoulders at that point. So he absolutely has got amazing breath control to be able to do that. Athletes that swim with a much higher stroke rate, their head will lift a little bit earlier. But what you don't want is the head leading the stroke.
Mm.
You want to make sure that the head is lifted, okay, within the arm stroke cycle, and it's the arms doing the work, not the head driving the stroke. Because as soon as that happens, you're going to end up creating more drag and going slower.
So it's interesting that you mentioned Anton Chupkov there. I did a blog post on Chupkov's stroke last week, and I think now would be a good point just to push listeners towards looking at that blog post. You can find it on the website. And again, you said there about not leading the stroke with the head. The amount of times I'm telling swimmers, you don't lift your hair, you don't move your head to breathe on breaststroke. It rises with the stroke naturally. I think, again, it's just a real crucial point there.
No, absolutely. And it's critical for body line. You know, in breaststroke, maintaining a streamlined position, well, it is with every stroke, we know that. But particularly in breaststroke, because the propulsive element and the drag elements, there's a big difference between each. Keeping a neutral head is so important to body line. And he's a good example of a breaststroker. We're moving on to talking a bit more breaststroke now. He's a good example of an athlete that can utilize two strokes. You know, on the first 50 of his 200, he'll generally move down the length at a stroke rate of 25, and he'll finish the last length at a stroke rate of 50, or certainly the last part of the last length. And he's got a very, very big range, okay, and able to, you know, do those two strokes. And we know there's other athletes, okay, that are able to do that in the breaststroke world as well. I'll definitely be going to your blog post to have a read of that. It'd be interesting.
When did the analysis of his, I think it was his 200 breast from, I think it was Worlds in 2019. I think his second 50, he did it in like 12 strokes or something like that. And then his 450, he did something like 18, 19, 20 strokes. So it just shows different parts of the races.
Yeah, it's a complete contrast. And that swim where he went to 06 was phenomenal in the way that he balanced the splits of going out in a 102 and coming back in a 103. I watched that race live, and it actually blew my mind the way that he managed to balance that. Because, you know, like, 200 breaststrokes to that point just did not done that way.
No, yeah.
And his ability to utilize two styles effectively means that he can experiment with putting a race together like that. But that style of swimming that race, or that makeup, that won't fit everybody.
Absolutely.
My belief is he's able to do that because he's got the range in his technique.
Absolutely. You spoke right at the start of the episode about kind of Molly Renshaw and James Wilby. James Wilby's got a much more kind of narrower stroke, and Molly's got a wider stroke. And you you try to narrow Molly's stroke to help 100, would you suggest that a narrower stroke is better for kind of 100 than it is yeah. 200?
Yes, because if you've got a wide stroke, there's only so quickly you can get around it.
Yeah.
So, for example, I always try to work with facts. And if someone listens to this podcast and they can put me right, okay, then fair enough. But when I was looking through, there was only one female that was swimming 65 seconds long course. Okay, that wasn't swimming above 50 rate. Maybe two. I think Liesl Jones was around 46 to 47 rate in the way that she put together a 105. And then Rikke Pedersen was the only one that just nipped under 66 with a mid to lower 40 rate. And that was the meet where she broke the world record on the 200 going 219 in 2013. And she swam the 200 in a 30 rate to break that world record. Now Molly swims identical to Rikke Pedersen on the 200. She swims a 30 to a 31 rate.
Yeah.
But I knew, okay, from the data and the facts, that to get Molly to move from a 108, that she weren't going to do it unless she could operate in a mid 40 rate. And the stroke was slightly too wide, and she weren't powerful enough to move into mid 40s without it becoming a greater drag for her. And often it would give her a negative return. Sometimes she could swim quicker at 31 rate because it was less drag. And when she would try to swim at say a 40 or a 42 rate, she'd go slower. And that's because she couldn't get back into line fast enough.
Yeah.
So with increased strength and trying to narrow the elbows and narrow the heels through the arm pull and through the leg kick, and a greater power. You know, we managed to get her to operate at around 42 to 44 rate really, really well. And that was the move into the 106 at the World Championships.
Ah, interesting. Let's just quickly go back to you as a younger coach. What were you doing to ensure that you were developing, you were getting better, you were learning all the time?
Well, there was elements of luck. I had some very, very good mentors at that time. My assistant coach, Gary Mohammed, he doesn't coach anymore, but he did at Hillingdon with me. I felt he was an amazing teacher of swimming. And just the way that he would communicate the point simply, his demonstrations. Now, I watched that on poolside every day for years. And I probably still coach or copy, because like I said, with the swimmers, you copy good practice. Yeah. That's still part of how I try and go about things now. And then I was quite lucky with the swimmers. So at that time, I had two girls, okay, that were doing a really, really good job at a European junior level. And that got me in the mix, okay, with a lot of the coaches that were coaching the senior athletes at that time.
Yeah,
I managed to connect and make networks with coaches like, who's my mentor now, Kev Renshaw, and Dave McNulty, coaches there that were at the top, and I managed to access information that really accelerated my learning. Hmm. So I was lucky in that respect, and not everyone gets that. Then not everyone gets that opportunity. So it's really important what I said at the beginning of the podcast. With people like yourself that are brave enough to come and have the conversations, you know, don't be scared with that. Do it, because, like, honestly, anyone that ever comes to speak to me, I'll try and make time for just to talk like I am now about
yeah.
some of the experiences that I'm lucky enough to have with the athletes that I'm coaching. A few other things. Always felt like I was curious to mm-hmm. learn. I had a passion for that. So I would want to read the McGlishko book from the first page to the last, which, you know, to me is still the swimming Bible and what I'll always kind of go back to. Took some really, really good opportunities in my time. I was lucky enough to go away to America, you know, and visit Loughborough with some of my swimmers, okay, that I had at Hillingdon, which was great. probably the biggest thing, okay, that I did was I made the move. I got to the point, I've been at Hillenden, I swam there and I coached there. I've been there 20 years and this coach intern position came up at Loughborough, and it was a big decision for me to make because at that time I was head coach at Hillenden. I was a PE teacher. I had a property. I was in a good place in my life. And this coach intern position came up and I was scratching my head because financially it didn't work for me. And I would move away from all my friends and family, you know. But the draw of working with Olympic level athletes and the opportunity to learn there and what it might do for me going forward in the career that and the sport that I love, I just had to take a punt and you know, go for the interview, and I was lucky enough to get the position then.
Absolutely. I think when I spoke to John Rudd on this podcast, he said that sometimes you've just because you're comfortable living at like almost where you grew up, your mum's around the corner, your nan's around the corner, you've got all your friends and family, doesn't mean that for your career you need to stay there. I think sometimes you've got to take that plunge, and like in your instance it seems to have paid off like almost tenfold, really.
I feel like I've probably, you know, there's been elements of luck, and you know, when I made that decision, it wasn't an easy decision for me to make. You know, there were days when I would think, no, like, this is too risky. You know, what if I don't like it? What if it don't work out? What if it don't work out? And you know, this is not what it's all cracked up to be. Now, where do I go then? I'm giving up my PE job and my club that I've worked years to try and get, you know, where I was, you know, quite proud of it. But you know, like in the end, you have to make a call, and you know, I did.
So what would you say to young coaches, perhaps a little bit like myself, who look up to coaches like you, with regards to the work you do and the passion you've got for the job that you do as well?
Well, the first, my main thing would always be to show energy. Mm-hmm. I think that's like it's a really, really important point, that your enthusiasm and energy on a daily basis, because the sport is hard and it's relentless and it has its ups and downs. So you need a high energy source to cope with that.
Yeah.
Sometimes we go through a lot of work for not a lot of return in terms of performance. We're working with people, and that's really, really rewarding. Yeah. But sometimes when we invest so much and we don't get the outcome, that's quite deflating. So it's always important that you hold a high level of enthusiasm and energy to get through those times, you know, because we're in it for the long haul now, and I think that's a really important point. In terms of getting better, like I've said to you numerous times already, connecting, making sure you're developing a network around you where you can draw upon people's knowledge and experiences is really good. Always stay curious and open-minded, even if you don't agree with something. At the moment, Kev Renshaw, my mentor, sending me a lot of stuff on USRPT. Although I wouldn't say that it's not my philosophy, but I try to, you know, go take parts of it and see where maybe it could fit, or whether or not it's challenging, you know, my current model and my thinking. So staying curious is really important. Trying to take opportunities to visit is really good. There's some coaches that, you know, do ask to come, and even people that are I look up to with great experience, the likes of Dave Champion, is always pestering me to come down to Loughborough to watch, because what he says to me is like, it's still a great learning experience for me, and I go away supercharged, you know. And I love it when he comes down, because I think to myself that there you've got young coaches and coaches that I still look up to and I learn from, still trying to come into the environment to take something away from it. So don't be scared to ask to visit or ask for a conversation. So those kind of things. It's about learning and stay enthusiastic and just try and always keep moving forward.
Absolutely. So just before we finish off, I always ask coach on this podcast at the end to kind of list top three tips for something, and each episode is slightly different. What would be your kind of top three tips for trying to affect a technical change?
Yeah. So my first one would be clear on what they're doing well, mm-hmm. and try to make that better. One of the things I admire with Adam Peaty and what Mel coaches him, she really, really makes the most of his strengths.
Yeah.
And even as good as he is, focusing on what he's good at, okay, continues to see him move forward. And don't change something unless it's really, really needed. But you don't know that until you can absolutely clarify what they're doing well.
Yeah.
The second point would be, when you're unsure of something, compare the differences. Take time to look at what world-class athletes are doing. Cut out some pictures, compare some videos. Try to see if you can identify something that's different, or something that you might not see otherwise doing that.
Yeah.
Because certainly for myself, that process, not only do you educate yourself, but often you do see things and you're like, right, that's something that I've really got to think about, and I wouldn't have noticed that unless I'd drawn the comparison.
Yeah.
My third point would be, make sure that you make it simple for the athlete and make sure that it's understood. Because I think those two things, if you make a complex point simple, they can process the information much quicker and much better. And if they understand it, they'll be more passionate about getting better at it, and that will probably result in a faster swimmer.
Absolutely. Well, Dave, thank you very much for your time. I've certainly learned a lot from this podcast. I'm sure the listeners will do too. Listeners, thank you for listening. I just want to point you towards our website. It's www.thepoolsidepass.com. We're on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Poolside Pass. And until we can get back in the water, make sure you keep learning, keep reflecting, and tune in to all our podcasts we've got coming out weekly. Thank you.